All right. Well, that's that. So today I want to spend some time talking about John Calvin and his vision for the church. Now, of all of the three men that we have discussed this week during the conference, there's a sense in which Calvin is the most of a lightning rod in terms of the way people think of him. It's really true to say that with Calvin, you either love him or you hate him. And so as I was thinking about this, you know, coming down here to spend some time with a group of believers that I don't know very well, I just thought, well, this will be fun. I wonder what'll happen when I introduce this man who I think there's a lot to love with John Calvin, even if you don't find yourself having complete affinity with all of his teachings, even if there are elements of his life that you find less appealing. And I've tried to show a real picture of all of these men, you know, warts and all, the history of these reformers. There is really none of them who are perfect. And it's wrong for us to elevate them unto the status of a super saint. And the same thing happens with Calvin. In fact, because of the various reactions that he has provoked over history, she's just telling us what she thinks about Calvin's theology, I'm sure. And that's fine. regardless of he's been portrayed in very different ways. And many of the ways in which he's been portrayed does not even reflect how he himself would desire to be portrayed. There is a fantastic statue of him in the city of Geneva. I forgot to actually get a picture of it to put in these notes. I meant to. And it's frequently been observed that that statue portrays Calvin in a way that he himself would not feel comfortable with. That, for one thing, it's a statue of him. And he would prefer us to remember his great God and the glorious gospel, the scriptures as he taught them. And so the very fact that they erected a statue of him kind of goes contrary to his own desires and expectations. In the midst of the way that people think about him, there is so many different views, so many strong opinions that historians can actually say that there is a need to go on what we call, what you might call, a quest for the historical Calvin. And if you know anything about the study of the Gospels, you know that's a play on the phrase the quest for the historical Jesus, which is a complex topic all on its own that I can't talk about here. That's for my Life of Christ and other Gospels classes. complex history that always surprises my students. All I'll say about it here is that there's a sense in which a lot of the scholarly publications on the Gospels themselves are not particularly devotionally helpful. So I tell my students after they read an introductory chapter that summarizes the quest for the historical Jesus, I say, well, now I've taken you through the desert to show you there's no water there. And that, then we turn and look at the gospel itself, how it portrays Jesus in all his glory, which is a much more encouraging picture than many of the historical Jesus scholars would actually give us. And with Calvin, the same kind of thing is there. You have to filter through the layers of prejudice, the layers of reactions to his life and work to get to the real Calvin. And I hope to give you just a glimpse of that man today and of his nature and personality. So here's a portrait of John Calvin. This is by Rene Boivin, or Boivin, and it is probably fairly historically accurate. Of course, there are many other depictions of Calvin that we have, So an image, something like this, is quite familiar to many of us in terms of what Calvin probably looked like. Calvin was born July 10th, 1509 in Lyon, France, which is 60 miles northeast of Paris. We know very little about his youth. In fact, one of the problems in this quest for the historical Calvin is that we frankly know very little about Calvin the man himself, unlike Luther, who tells us everything, including stuff we don't want to know, in a very literal way. I won't go into any more on that. Calvin carefully avoids telling us much about himself. He's the quintessential shy biblical scholar. And so we don't know much about his upbringing. In his commentary on the Psalms, he gives us a brief glimpse in the preface. Actually, I have a little bit on that here. Let me just show it to you. This is from his commentary on the Psalms. Sorry if it's a little bit hard to see on the screen, and this isn't in my notes that are publicly available. I might be able to update it later today and get that in there for you. he says, "The varied and resplendent riches which are contained in this treasury, it is no easy matter to express in words, so much so that I well know that whatever I shall be able to say will be far from approaching the excellence of the subject. But as it is better to give my readers some taste, however small, of the wonderful advantages they will derive from the study of this book than to be entirely silent on the point, I may be permitted briefly to advert to a matter the greatness of which does not admit of being fully unfolded. I have been accustomed to call this book, I think not inappropriately, an anatomy of all the parts of the soul, for there is not an emotion of which anyone can be conscious that he is not here represented as in a mirror." So he's talking about the Psalms, he's calling it the anatomy of the soul. He's saying that in the Psalms we find all of the emotions that we've experienced reflected. He says, "Or rather, the Holy Spirit has here drawn to the life all the griefs, sorrows, fears, doubts, hopes, cares, perplexities, in short, all the distracting emotions with which the minds of men are wont to be agitated. The other parts of Scripture contain the commandments which God enjoined his servants to announce to us. But here the prophets themselves, seeing they are exhibited to us as speaking to God and laying open all their inmost thoughts and affections, call, or rather draw, each of us to the examination of himself in particular, in order that none of the many infirmities to which we are subject and of the many vices with which we abound may remain concealed. It is certainly a rare and singular advantage when all lurking places are discovered and the heart is brought into the light, purged from the most baneful infection, hypocrisy. In short, as calling upon God is one of the principal means of securing our safety, and as a better and more unerring rule for guiding us in this exercise cannot be found elsewhere than in the Psalms, it follows that in proportion to the proficiency of which a man shall have attained in understanding them will be his knowledge of the most important part of celestial doctrine. Genuine and earnest prayer proceeds first from a sense of our need, and next from faith in the promises of God. It is by perusing these inspired compositions that men will be most effectually awakened to a sense of their maladies, and at the same time instructed in seeking remedies for their cure. In a word, whatever may serve to encourage us when we are about to pray to God is taught us in this book. And not only are the promises of God presented to us in it, but oftentimes there is exhibited to us one standing, as it were, amidst the invitations of God on the one hand and the impediments of the flesh on the other, girding and preparing himself for prayer, thus teaching us, if at any time we are agitated with a variety of doubts, to resist and fight against them, until the soul, freed and disentangled from all these impediments, rise up to God. And not only so, but even when in the midst of doubts, fears, and apprehensions, let us put forth our efforts in prayer, until we experience some consolation which may calm and bring contentment to our minds. Although distrust may shut the gate against our prayers, Yet we must not allow ourselves to give way whenever our hearts waver or are agitated with inquietude, but must persevere until faith finally come forth victorious from these conflicts. In many places we perceive the exercise of the servants of God in prayer so fluctuating that they are almost overwhelmed by the alternate hope of success and apprehension of failure, and gain the prize only by strenuous exertions. We see on the one hand the flesh manifesting its infirmity, and on the other faith putting forth its power. And if it is not so valiant and courageous as might be desired, it is at least prepared to fight until by degrees it acquire perfect strength. But as these things which serve to teach us the true method of praying aright will be found scattered throughout the whole of this commentary, I will now stop to treat of topics which will be necessary afterwards to repeat, nor detain my readers from proceeding to the work itself. Only it appeared to me to be requisite to show in passing that this book makes known to us this privilege, which is desirable above all others, that not only is there opened up to us familiar access to God, but also that we have permission and freedom granted us to lay open before Him our infirmities, which we would be ashamed to confess before men. Besides, there is also here prescribed to us an infallible rule for directing us with respect to the right manner of offering to God the sacrifice of praise, which He declares to be most precious in His sight and of the sweetest odor. There is no other book in which there is found to be more express and magnificent commendations both of the unparalleled liberality of God toward His church and of all His works. There is no other book in which there are recorded so many deliverances, nor one in which the evidences and experiences, scrolling in the middle of a long paragraph is risky. There it is. Of the fatherly providence and solicitude which God exercises toward us are celebrated with such splendor of diction and yet with the strictest adherence to truth. In short, there is no other book in which we are more perfectly taught the right manner of praising God, or in which we are more powerfully stirred up to the performance of this religious exercise. Moreover, although the Psalms are replete with all the precepts which serve to frame our life to every part of holiness, piety, and righteousness, yet they will principally teach and train us to bear the cross. And the bearing of the cross is a genuine proof of our obedience, since by doing this we renounce the guidance of our own affections and submit ourselves entirely to God, leaving Him to govern us and to dispose of our life according to His will, so that the afflictions, which are the bitterest and most sincere of our nature, become sweet to us because they proceed from Him. In one word, not only will we here find general commendations of the goodness of God, which may teach men to repose themselves in Him alone, and to seek all their happiness solely in the Him, and which are intended to teach true believers with their whole hearts confidently to look to Him for help in all these necessities, but we will also find that the free remission of sins, which alone reconciles God toward us and procures for us settled peace with Him, is so set forth and magnified as that here there is nothing wanting which relates to the knowledge of eternal salvation. Now, if my readers derive any fruit and advantage from the labor which I have bestowed in writing these commentaries, I would have them to understand that the small measure of experience which I have had by the conflicts with which the Lord has exercised me has in no ordinary degree assisted me, not only in applying to present use whatever instruction could be gathered from these divine compositions, but also in more easily comprehending the design of each of the writers. And as David holds the principal place among them, it has greatly aided me in understanding more fully the complaints made by him of the internal afflictions with which the church had to sustain those who gave themselves out to be her members, that I suffered the same or similar things from domestic enemies of the church. For although I follow David at a great distance and come far short of equaling him, or rather, although in aspiring slowly and with great difficulty to attain to the many virtues in which he excelled, I still find myself tarnished with the contrary vices. Yet if I have any things in common with him, I have no hesitation in comparing myself with him, In reading the instances of his faith, patience, fervor, zeal, and integrity, it has, as it ought, drawn from me unnumbered groans and sighs that I am so far from approaching them. But it has notwithstanding been a very great advantage to me to behold in him as in a mirror both the commencement of my calling and the continued course of my function, so that I know the more assuredly that whatever the most illustrious king and prophet suffered was exhibited to me by God as an example for imitation. My condition, no doubt, is much inferior to his, and it is unnecessary for me to stay to show this. But as he was taken from the sheepfold and elevated to the rank of supreme authority, so God, having taken me from my originally obscure and humble condition, has reckoned me worthy of being invested with the honorable office of a preacher and minister of the gospel. When I was as yet a very little boy, my father had destined me for the study of theology. But afterward, when he considered that the legal profession commonly raised those who followed it to wealth, this prospect induced him suddenly to change his purpose. Thus it came to pass that I was withdrawn from the study of philosophy and was put to the study of law. To this pursuit I endeavored faithfully to apply myself in obedience to the will of my father. But God, by the secret guidance of his providence, at length gave me a different direction to my course. And first, since I was too obstinately devoted to the superstitions of popery to be easily extricated from so profound an abyss of mire, God, by a sudden conversion, subdued and brought my mind to a teachable frame, which was more hardened in such matters than might have been expected from one at my early period of life. Having thus received some taste and knowledge of true godliness, I was immediately inflamed with so intense a desire to make progress therein, that although I did not altogether leave off other studies, I yet pursued them with less ardor. I was quite surprised to find that before a year had elapsed, all who had any desire after purer doctrine were continually coming to me to learn, although I myself was as yet but a mere novice and tyro. Being of a disposition somewhat unpolished and bashful, which led me always to love the shade and retirement, I then began to seek some secluded corner where I might be withdrawn from the public view. But so far from being able to accomplish the object of my desire, all my retreats were like public schools. In short, whilst my one great object was to live in seclusion without being known, God so led me about through different turnings and changes that he never permitted me to rest in any place until, in spite of my natural disposition, he brought me forth to public notice. Leaving my native country, France, I in fact retired into Germany expressly for the purpose of being able there to enjoy in some obscure corner the repose which I had always desired and which had been so long denied me. But lo, whilst I lay hidden at Basel, and known only to a few people, many faithful and holy persons were burned alive in France, and the report of these burnings having reached foreign nations, they excited the strongest disapprobation among a great part of the Germans, whose indignation was kindled against the authors of such tyranny. In order to allay this indignation, certain wicked and lying pamphlets were circulated, stating that none were treated with such cruelty but Anabaptists and seditious persons, who by their perverse ravings and false opinions were overthrowing not only religion but also all civil order. Observing that the object which these instruments of the court aimed at by their disguises was not only that the disgrace of shedding so much innocent blood might remain buried under the false charges and calumnies with which they brought against the holy martyrs after their death, but also that afterward they might be able to proceed to the utmost extremity in murdering the poor saints without exciting compassion toward them in the breasts of any, it appeared to me that unless I opposed them to the utmost of my ability, my silence could not be vindicated from the charge of cowardice and treachery. This was the consideration which induced me to publish my Institutes of the Christian Religion. My objects were first to prove that these reports were false and calumnious, and thus to vindicate my brethren, whose death was precious in the sight of the Lord. And next, that as the same cruelties might very soon after be exercised against many unhappy individuals, foreign nations might be touched with at least some compassion toward them and solicitude about them. When it was then published, It was not that copious and labored work which it now is, but only a small treatise containing a summary of the principal truths of the Christian religion. And it was published with no other design than that men might know what was the faith held by those whom I saw basely and wickedly defamed by those flagitous and perfidious flatterers. What wonderful vocabulary there. That my object was not to acquire fame appeared from this, that immediately after I left Basel, and particularly from the fact that nobody there knew that I was the author. Wherever else I have gone, I have taken care to conceal that I was the author of that performance, and I had resolved to continue in the same privacy and obscurity until at length William Farrell, we'll talk about William here in a minute, detained me at Geneva not so much by counsel and exhortation as by a dreadful imprecation, which I felt to be as if God from heaven laid his mighty hand upon me to arrest me. As the most direct route to Strasbourg, to which I then intended to retire, was shut up by the wars, and I had resolved to pass quickly by Geneva, without staying longer than a single night in the city. A little before this, popery had been driven from it by the exertions of the excellent person whom I have named, and Peter Verret. But matters were not yet brought to a settled state, and the city was divided into unholy and dangerous factions. Then an individual who now basely apostatized and returned to the papist discovered me and made me known to others. Upon this, Farrell, who burned with an extraordinary zeal to advance the gospel, immediately strained every nerve to detain me. And after having learned that my heart was set upon devoting myself to private studies, for which I wished to keep myself free from other pursuits, and finding that he gained nothing by entreaties, he proceeded to utter an imprecation that God would curse my retirement and the tranquility of the studies which I sought if I should withdraw and refuse to give assistance when the necessity was so urgent. By this imprecation, I was so stricken with terror that I desisted from the journey which I had taken. But as sensible of my natural bashfulness and timidity, I would not bring myself under obligation to discharge any particular office. After that, 4 months had scarcely elapsed when, on the one hand, the Anabaptists began to assail us, and on the other, a certain wicked apostate who, being secretly supported by the influence of some of the magistrates of the city, was thus enabled to give us a great deal of trouble. At the same time, a succession of dissensions fell out in the city that strangely afflicted us. Being, as I acknowledge, naturally of a timid, soft, and pusillanimous disposition. Does anyone know what that word means? There we go. Lacking courage or determination. Timid. Okay? Not part of our common usage anymore, I'm afraid. So timid disposition. I was compelled to encounter these violent tempests as part of my early training. And although I did not sink under them, yet I was not sustained by such greatness of mind as not to rejoice more than it became me when, in consequence of certain commotions, I was banished from Geneva. By this means, set at liberty and loosed from the tie of my vocation, I resolved to live in a private station, free from the burden and cares of any public charge, when that most excellent servant of Christ, Martin Bucer, employing a similar kind of remonstrance and protestation as that to which Farrell had recourse before, drew me back to a new station. Alarmed by the example of Jonas, which he set before me, I still continued in the work of teaching. And although I had always continued, like myself, studiously avoiding celebrity, yet I was carried, I know not how, as it were, by force to the imperial assemblies, where, willing or unwilling, I was under the necessity of appearing before the eyes of many. Afterward, when the Lord, having compassion on this city, had allayed the hurtful agitations and broils which prevailed in it, and by his wonderful power had defeated both the wicked counsels and the sanguinary attempts of the disturbers of the Republic, necessity was imposed upon me of returning to my former charge, contrary to my desire and inclination. So he's talking about the fact that he does get called back to Geneva here. And again, his whole life, he's just searching for a quiet place to study. And he, unfortunately, for his own desires, he never gets it. The closest he gets is this time in Strasbourg under Bucer. But really, he's constantly just pushed out into public service, contrary to his own desires. As something of an introvert myself, I totally identify with this. I can just understand how much he would just rather not be responsible for leading a whole city. I would rather just go study in a corner somewhere and spend his life surrounded by his books. But unfortunately for him, and fortunately for the world, he doesn't get that opportunity. Okay, where were we? Here we were. The welfare of this church, it is true, lay so near my heart that for its sake I would not have hesitated to lay down my life. But my timidity nevertheless suggested to me many reasons for excusing myself from again willingly taking upon my shoulders so heavy a burden. At length, however, a solemn and conscientious regard to my duty prevailed with me to consent to return to the flock from which I had been torn. But with what grief, tears, great anxiety, and distress I did this, and the Lord is my best witness, and many godly persons who would have wished to see me delivered from this painful state, had it not been that which I feared and which made me give my consent, prevented them and shut their mouths. Were I to narrate the various conflicts by which the Lord has exercised me since that time, and by what trials he has proved me, it would make a long history. But that I may not become tedious to my readers by a waste of words. Here's the introvert again coming out. I'm like, oh, you know, you're probably bored. And we're all like, no, please tell us more. I much more so than Luther, I get this guy. I shall content myself with repeating briefly what I have touched upon a little before, that in considering the whole course of the life of David, it seemed to me that by his own footsteps he showed me the way, and from this I have experienced no small consolation. As that holy king was harassed by the Philistines and other foreign enemies with continual wars, while he was much more grievously afflicted by the malice and wickedness of some perfidious men amongst his own people, so I can say as to myself that I have been assailed on all sides and have scarcely been able to enjoy repose for a single moment, but have always had to sustain some conflict, either from enemies without or within the church. Satan has made many attempts to overthrow the fabric of this church, and once it came to this, that I, although feeble and timorous as I am, was compelled to break and put a stop to his deadly assaults by putting my life in danger and opposing my person to his blows. Afterward, for the space of 5 years, when some wicked libertines were furnished with undue influence, and also some of the common people, corrupted by the allurements and perverse discourse of such persons, desired to obtain the liberty of doing whatever they pleased without control, I was under the necessity of fighting without ceasing to defend and maintain the discipline of the church. To these irreligious characters and despisers of the heavenly doctrine, it was a matter of entire indifference, although the church should sink into ruin, provided they obtained what they sought, the power of acting just as they pleased. Many, too, harassed by poverty and hunger, and others impelled by insatiable ambition or avarice and a desire of dishonest gain, were become so frantic that they chose rather, by throwing all things into confusion, to involve themselves and us in one common ruin than to remain quiet by living peaceably and honestly. During the whole of this lengthened period, I think that there is scarcely any of the weapons which are forged in the workshop of Satan which has not been employed by them in order to obtain their object. And at length matters had come to such a state that an end could be put to their machinations in no other way than cutting them off by an ignominious death, which was indeed a painful and pitiable spectacle to me. They no doubt deserved the severest punishment, but I always desired that they might live in prosperity and continue safe and untouched, which would have been the case had they not been altogether incorrigible and obstinately refused to listen to wholesome admonition. The trial of these 5 years was grievous and hard to bear, but I experienced not less excruciating pain from the malignity of those who ceased not to assail myself and my ministry with their envenomed calumnies. A great proportion of them, it is true, are so blinded by a passion for slander and detraction that their great disgrace, they betray at once their own impudence, while others, however crafty and cunning, cannot so cover or disguise themselves as to escape being shamefully convicted and disgraced. Yet when a man has been 100 times found innocent of a charge brought against him, and when the charge is again repeated without any cause or occasion, it is an indignity hard to bear. Because I affirm and maintain that the world is managed and governed by the secret providence of God. A multitude of presumptuous men rose up against me and alleged that I represent God as the author of sin. This is so foolish a calumny that it would of itself quickly come to nothing, but did I not meet with persons who have tickled ears and who have take pleasure in feeding upon such discourse? But there are many whose minds are so filled with envy and spleen, or ingratitude or malignity, that there is no falsehood, however preposterous, yea, even monstrous, which they do not receive if it is spoken of them. Others endeavor to overthrow God's eternal purpose of predestination, by which he distinguishes between the reprobate and the elect. Others take upon them to defend free will, and forthwith many throw themselves into their ranks, not so much through ignorance as by a perversity of zeal which I know not how to characterize. If they were open and avowed enemies who brought these troubles upon me, the thing might in some way be borne, but that those who shroud themselves under the name of brethren, and not only eat Christ's sacred bread, but also administer it to others, that those, in short, who loudly boast of being preachers of the gospel, should wage such nefarious war against me, how detestable is it? In this matter, I may very justly complain with David. Yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, who did eat of my bread, lifted up his heel against me. Psalm 41:9. For it was not an enemy that reproached me, but it was thou, a man of mine equal, my guide and mine acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked into the house of God in company. Psalm 55:12-14. Others circulated ridiculous reports concerning my treasures. Others of the extravagant authority and enormous influence which they say I possess. Others speak of my delicacies and magnificence. But when a man is content with scanty food and common clothing and does not require from the humblest more frugality than he shows and practices himself, shall it be said that such a one is too sumptuous and lives in too high a style? As to the power and influence of which they envy me, I wish I could discharge this burden upon them, for they estimate my power by the multitude of affairs and the vast weight of labors with which I am overwhelmed. And if there are some whom I cannot persuade whilst I am alive that I am not rich, my death at length will prove it. I confess indeed that I am not poor, for I desire nothing more than what I have. All these are invented stories, and there is no color whatever for any one of them. But many nevertheless are very easily persuaded of their truth and applaud them. And the reason is because the greatest part judge that the only means of cloaking their enormities is to throw all things into disorder and to confound black and white. And they think the best and shortest way by which they can obtain full liberty to live with impunity just as they please is to destroy the authority of Christ's servants. In addition to these, there are the hypocritical mockers and feasts of whom David complains. And I mean that by these, not only lick dish characters who seek a meal to fill their belly, but all those who by false report seek to obtain the favor of the great. Having been long accustomed to swallow such wrongs as these, I have become almost hardened. Yet when the insolence of such characters increases, I cannot but sometimes feel my heart wounded with bitter pangs. Nor was it enough that I should be so inhumanly treated by my neighbors. In addition to this, in a distant country toward the frozen ocean, where there was raised, I know not how, by the frenzy of few, a storm which afterwards stirred up against me a vast number of persons, who are too much at leisure and having nothing to do but by their bickering to hinder those who are laboring for the edification of the church. I'm still speaking of the internal enemies of the church, of those who, boasting mightily of the gospel of Christ, nevertheless rush against me with greater impetuosity than against the open adversaries of the church, because I do not embrace their gross and fictitious notion concerning a carnal way of eating Christ in the sacrament, and of whom I may protest after the example of David, I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. Moreover, the cruel ingratitude of all of them is manifest in this, that they scruple not to assail, both in flank and rear, a man who strenuously exerts himself to maintain a cause which they have in common with him, and with whom, therefore, they ought to aid and succor. Certainly, if such persons were possessed of even a small portion of humanity, The fury of the papists, which is directed against me with such unbridled violence, would appease the most implacable animosity which they may bear toward me. But since the condition of David was such that though he had deserved well of his own people, he was nevertheless bitterly hated by many without cause, as he complains in Psalm 69:4. I restored that which I took not away. It afforded me no small consolation when I was groundlessly assailed by the hatred of those who ought to have assisted and solaced me to conform himself to the example of so great and so excellent a person. This knowledge and experience have been of much service in enabling me to understand the Psalms, so that in my meditations upon them I did not wander, as it were, in an unknown region. My readers, too, if I mistake not, will observe that in folding the internal affections both of David and of others, I discourse upon them as matters of which I have familiar experience. Moreover, since I have labored faithfully to open up this treasure for the use of all the people of God, although what I have done has not been equal to my wishes, yet the attempt which I have made deserves to be received with some measure of favor. Still, I only ask that each may judge of my labors with justice and candor, according to the advantage and fruit which he shall derive from them. Certainly, as I have said before, in reading these commentaries, it will be clearly seen that I have not sought to please, unless in so far as I might be at the same time profitable to others. And therefore, I have not only observed throughout a simple style of teaching, but in order to be removed the further from all ostentation, I have also generally abstained from refuting the opinions of others, although this presented a more favorable opportunity for plausible display, and of acquiring the applause of those who shall favor my book with a perusal. I have never touched upon opposite opinions, unless where there was reason to fear that by being silent respecting them, I might leave my readers in doubt and perplexity. At the same time, I am sensible that it would have been much more agreeable to the taste of many had I heaped together a great mass of materials which has great show and acquires fame for the writer, but I have felt nothing to be of more importance than to have a regard to the edification of the church. May God, who has implanted this desire in my heart, grant by his grace that the success may correspond thereto. So in this little sketch, you capture a little bit of his heart. And it's interesting how he puts it all in this context, not because he thinks his life is really all that important, but he wants you to understand that when he writes about the Psalms, he writes as somebody who feels as though he has participated in similar kinds of experiences to the psalmist. And so he goes to all this length to describe, in frankly a rather indirect way, his sufferings and persecution. And so he says that he is thus better able and equipped to help you to understand the Psalms. It's also interesting, and I think a testimony to the purpose that he has for this work, that he tells us that he didn't do what would have been easy, to just refute the opinions of others, which would have gotten lots of accolades for him. Instead, he just tells you what he thinks the text means. And except for the rare cases where if he was silent about those debates, you would think that perhaps he believed something he didn't. And that goes contrary in many ways to the writing style that you'll find in a lot of the commentaries that are even published to this day. Many readers of commentaries, including my students, often complain that it takes pages and pages and pages to find out what the author of the commentary actually thinks about the issue, because first they go through all of the other guys' opinions. And I've told this to my students many times, that when they get into a section like that, a way to navigate through is to go through and just kind of highlight the next view is, or this guy says, and just try to summarize in your mind in a sentence each view. And most of the time, the last one that the guy is going to present in the commentary, he's probably going to then argue is the best. So he'll set up all the opposing views, and then at the very end, he'll set up the one that he likes, and then he'll tell you why he likes it. And most of the time, that's kind of how that works. But Calvin specifically avoided that kind of pattern in his writing on the Psalms. He wanted to edify you. He wanted to help you to understand the text. And so his focus was strictly on providing simple and understandable explanation of the Bible itself. Parker says in his biography of Calvin that Calvin's theology was so old-fashioned that it seemed a novelty. And he was an ironic figure in that he stood for unity, and yet he was the first to see the religiously motivated civil wars that afflicted Europe during this time. He lost his mother at an early age, and his father, we know, did remarry. And you saw in that autobiographical sketch just a glimmer of this, that he was a very tender and very emotional man. He is in personality the almost complete opposite of the firebrand Luther. He is someone who takes personal attacks very hardly, whereas Luther almost seems to just thrive on controversy. There's nothing that Luther seems to enjoy more better than a fierce theological debate with lots of name-calling thrown in just for good measure. His father sent him to Paris to study for the priesthood, and there's this constant theme in Calvin's life of obedience to his father. For some reason, which he hints at there in the autobiographical sketch, his father later changes his mind. We don't know what it was that caused him to change his mind and to think that the priesthood was not a lucrative pursuit. So he sends and asks him to study law, which Calvin did, which led him to study at Paris, Orléans, and Bourges. We're not certain why his father requested this. We do know he wanted him to get a good job, and one speculation is that Calvin's father had heard about Luther, and he figured that the whole grand scheme of the church is going to soon collapse. And so being a priest will no longer be a very profitable thing. So go study law. That'll be a good career for you, son.
So does Calvin write mostly in French then? That's his native tongue?
It is his first language, yes. And so now he's educated like any educated scholar of his day. He also knows Latin. And of course, to survive and get around, I imagine he would have been competent in German as well. But yes, the institutes go through several editions. He publishes them in French and Latin. I'm a little bit foggy on the publication history of the institutes and all the various editions that are out there. But there is quite a bit of variation that goes on there. And as he hinted at in that sketch, they grow. So you know, when you say, I'm going to read Calvin's institutes, to be historically precise, you really should indicate which institutes you're going to read. And of course, I assume that like me, you would have to read them in English translation. I should maybe just pull up sometime one of the French editions and ask my wife how it is to read. She grew up in Quebec and is fluent in French. She once tried to teach me, but that was while we were dating, and she discovered that she just wanted to talk to me. So she didn't have time to waste on, getting vocabulary into my head. And then we got married and had kids, and so far I haven't picked up French again since. And we moved to Alberta too, where, you know, knowing French is perhaps disadvantageous. You know, you don't want to come across as not a Westerner, which I am, and proud to affirm that I'm from out here. So the Reformation in France never really took off. There was a humanist writer, and every time I go through these notes, I ask my wife how to pronounce his name. I believe it goes something like this, Jacques Lefebvre de Tapel, something like that, but ask Meg on Sunday if you really want to hear how you're supposed to say it. Calvin was influenced by this theme in France. He interacted with groups that desired reform, And at some point along the way, he was converted. We were not certain when this occurred. And you may remember in that sketch that he just gave us, he just refers to this evangelical conversion, but he doesn't give us anything to really tell us when that happened. All we know is that at some point this happened, and Calvin eventually emerges as an evangelical preacher. It was clear in his mind that there was some point along the way in which he was converted, but we are simply not sure when this occurred. And so this is unlike Luther, who really developed his understanding gradually over time. Also unlike Luther, Calvin does not seem to have gone through a long period of struggle over his sin. He recognized the truth, he changed his mind, and he never contemplated going back. In 1522, he published his first book. Now, he didn't mention this in the biographical sketch, because it was called A Commentary on De Clementa. It's a work on Seneca, the Roman orator and politician. This was in keeping with his career in law. At some point, he came into contact with a man named Nicholas Kopp, who had been converted to the gospel. Asked to give a speech, Kopp called for reform. And there is some question. We aren't completely sure if this speech that Kopp gave was actually written by Calvin. Calvin and Kopp were then kicked out of the school and were ostracized because they were associated with the Reformation. And so he has to flee France and seems to have gone to Italy and then Switzerland. Here's our map that we looked at last night of Switzerland during this time. Last night we were spending our time in the region surrounding Zurich for the life of Ulrich Zwingli. Calvin's time is spent primarily in the western part of Switzerland, in keeping with his French origin and his ongoing concern for the growth of the Reformation in France. As he told us in that sketch, he was on his way to Strasbourg, and it's odd, Strasbourg is located sort of up here in Germany. He wanted to go there and enjoy the quiet life of the scholar to study. And he comes from Basel, and you think, why is it that he goes all the way down here to Geneva on his way up to Strasbourg? As he told you, it's because the best way is blocked by war. So on his way through, after he has been in Basel for some time, published the Institutes there for the first time, he's achieved some notoriety because he's written the Institutes, made himself known as an evangelical, as a someone who is sympathetic to the cause of reform. And so it's here that Farrell accosts him and impels him to say, by means of this sharp imprecation. So, just backing up again, in 1536, we find him in Basel. It's not exactly clear all the different places he went in between his exile from France and his appearance there in Basel. It's here that he publishes the first edition of the Institutes of the Christian Religion. This book is two things. It is first an apology for the Protestant cause to the King of France, and second, it is a statement of the Christian faith. It's a remarkably Protestant work for a man who is relatively young. Now, as I mentioned, we know he was headed for Strasbourg at this time in pursuit of a quiet life out of the limelight. On his way, he passes through Geneva, which is at this point a small town. As he told us, he wanted to stay one night, but a man named Guillaume Farrell implored him to stay longer. Now, Farrell is a fascinating individual. He was a red-headed, loud-mouthed, powerful, reforming preacher. He was a mover and a shaker. He destroyed more than he built. He was wise enough to know his own weaknesses, and he knew that he was not an educator or a leader capable of establishing a long-term movement. He knew that he couldn't reform Geneva. And so Farrell told Calvin that the Lord had informed him that Calvin was going to stay in Geneva, and forced him to stay against his will. I thought I could maybe grab this quote very quickly here, where Farrell impels him. Okay, no, I don't have it. Okay. We got a glimpse of it in that introduction to the Psalms, where he says that basically Farrell tells him that if you go into your life of repose in Strasbourg there and study, I have this almost vision from the Lord that God will curse you in your solitude and study. And it's striking that Calvin is sensitive enough. Okay, I mean, this is a little bit preposterous, isn't it? Perhaps. I mean, really? Did Farrell get this from God? I'm curious. But Calvin is so sensitive to God's direction in his life that he takes it seriously. And he says, well, what if God would actually curse my repose and solitude and study there in Strasbourg? So he stays in Geneva. And so God uses this hot-headed, perhaps impulsive preacher to restrain Calvin from pursuing his desire. And Calvin stays in Geneva. Geneva, at the time, is a growing middle-class city. It was profligate with democratic organization and little influence by the church. Now, the city leadership did recognize that there is a need for moral guidance in the city. And so throughout his life, aside from this brief interrupted period where he's in Strasbourg, Calvin is a pastor there. And he did not look down upon the work of the preacher. There's this idea out there that Calvin is this pointy-headed intellectual, right? We all just kind of think of that because of the massive superstructure of theology that's gotten built around his name by his followers. And yet Calvin very seriously regarded his responsibility to his people as a pastor. And so he considered the work of the pastor to be the most important and influential position in the church. It's easy to think, and people, I think, get this idea that there's this hierarchy of responsibility, and that in some senses the scholars within the society today, within the church, are to be revered and respected above even our own pastors. Calvin would not accept this notion. For all his intellectual gifts, he actually valued the work of the pastor more highly than the work of the scholar. And there's certainly a place in which scholarship and a role that he saw for scholarship, for the life of the mind. We'll talk about how he organizes that in the city of Geneva in a few minutes. But Calvin considered the work of the pastor itself to be of prime and supreme importance. And so rather than just spending his time as much as he would love to in studies, he is involved in the life of his people. He preaches consecutively through the New Testament. He begins in the book of Matthew, and he proceeds in order through the New Testament. He drew up a confession of faith. He reintroduced psalm singing into the church, and he worked within the council to bring about civil law that favored reform and the termination of sinful things such as adultery, homosexuality, theft, etc. Now, this does not make Calvin popular. And to this day, many of the caricatures of Calvin, that he was this stern, inflexible dictator, this moralist, this man who restrictively confined the life of the Genevan citizens to a high moral code, comes from the fact that he is working within the magisterial through the civil magistrate to bring about a reformed life, a life of holiness and obedience to God. And he has many, many opponents during this time. It's during this time that he is persecuted in very real ways. He recalled that, quote, "I have been saluted in derision outside my door in the evening by 50 or 60 arquebus shots." And he added, "You may well imagine how this could astonish a poor, timid scholar such as I am and always have been." Now, if you aren't up on your medieval weaponry, an arquebus is that wide-mouthed precursor to the rifle that develops in the late medieval period and was very quickly overtaking the role of the archer in late medieval, early modern warfare. I got curious when I read that quote a few months ago, and I went and did a little research on these things. The arquebus is sometimes also called the blunderbuss. Okay, it's that it's kind of got this, you know, it doesn't have spiraling inside like rifles today. It doesn't have that narrow. I'm going to betray my ignorance of guns. Thanks. Yeah, muzzle. And so it's actually incredibly imprecise. The way that they would use these things in warfare is that you'd have a unit of these guys and they'd just blast it in the general direction of your opponents, and that would cause lots of havoc as it just rips through your enemies. But it wasn't actually as precise as a single archer with his arrow could be. So an archer could target somebody from a long way off and could very effectively, you know, strike the target at a really particularly vulnerable point. Blunderbuss groups, they can't do that. So why does the blunderbuss become more popular? Well, it's a technological shift. The blunderbuss, though it's inaccurate, doesn't depend on a number of things that make archery relatively inefficient. For one thing, a skilled archer takes years to train, frankly, a whole lifetime. You can teach a guy how to use a blunderbuss within a matter of a few months. More beyond that, a blunderbuss doesn't require a whole lot of physical strength to operate, whereas the archer has to be in top flight condition to be effective. In fact, if he's sick, he's less useful on the battlefield. So that's why this blunderbuss, inaccurate though it was becoming more and more common. And apparently, a few times when Calvin would step out his door, some high life from Geneva would unload one in his general direction. And you can imagine somebody who spends his life reading how utterly, completely disorienting that would be. We're just grateful to God that they always missed. So, many in the city thought that Calvin was too strict. And so he's eventually run out of town. Some of these people who had a more libertine view of Christian life and behavior were in positions of authority within city council and eventually were able to force him out. And so Farrell left for the town of Neuchâtel. Calvin leaves for Strasbourg. Part of the difficulty was that Farrell and Calvin are both considered to be Frenchmen. And so they're considered to be outsiders in Geneva society. Martin Bucer called on Calvin, insisting that he come to Strasbourg, and it is here that Calvin pastors a congregation of perhaps 400 to 500 French emigres or refugees. He actually liked Strasbourg very much. It was a quieter city than Geneva. He could be out of the limelight in some ways, more so than he could be in Geneva. It was, however, a sad time for him. While he was here, he lost many of his dearest friends, including his nephew and others. Another event that was almost worse was when Louis du Tillet, who is perhaps a university classmate of his, returned to the Roman Catholic Church. This became personal when Du Tillet wrote Calvin and said that his banishment from Geneva was because of God's judgment on his life. He also had some friends who decided that Calvin needed a good wife. And this is kind of humorous. You can just imagine the awkward, shy scholar whose friends just say, you know what, this man needs some help. And so they could try to help him. And of course, you know how whenever people try to help each other get married, it doesn't always work out quite right the first couple times around. And that's certainly what happened with Calvin's experience. But here's the thing. Calvin, ever shy and introverted as he is, he's also just an organized and intellectual sort of fellow. So he gave his friends a list of qualities that he desired in a wife. And the first two young ladies that they found didn't meet up to those standards. So that didn't work out. He does eventually marry. He marries a woman named Idelette de Bure, and they had one son who unfortunately died within a few days. This was devastating for Calvin. He grieves for a long time, and it was even worse. The critics immediately said that this was a sign of God's judgment on his actions, of all the cruel and harmful things to say. This was said regarding the death of Calvin's child. Calvin wrote many commentaries on the scripture. Oh, yes, that would be great. I do sometimes forget to do that. Let's take a break. Thanks.